Good afternoon. That's a good turnout for this session. I'm Richard Allen. I'm just here to chair the session. I have two jobs. One is to make sure that it finishes at 3:50, and the other is to shut these guys down if they say anything seditious. It'll be a short session. So without further ado, if I can introduce Rob McKinn and Richard Pope, who are going to do a double act. I suggest for discussion we save that till the end of their presentation, but if you want to clarify anything for accuracy as we go that you think everybody should have the answer to, then stick your hand up and I'll try and catch your eye and just get that question in as we go. But otherwise, general discussion please at the end of Rob and Richard's presentation. Thanks.
Hello. So this presentation kind of started, does this work? Started out kind of with this diagram and this book here, which I read a while ago and Rob's read more recently. It's by a guy called Anthony Sampson, who's a journalist who's now, who died a couple of years ago. And he first wrote a book in the 60s with a similar title, so his business who runs this place. A similar title in the 60s where he tried to work out where power lived in the UK at that time, so at that particular time, sort of trade unions, monarchy, church had a lot of power. And he rewrote it from scratch every decade up until the last one he did, which was beginning of the 21st century. And the beginning and end of the book, there's this diagram here, which tries to map out in an admittedly arbitrary way. It's based on his knowledge as a journalist and investigation rather than any kind of statistical basis. But with different circles of the area, different parts of the UK government and non-government and everything. And trying to give them some kind of idea of overlap, of size, of influence, and all these kind of things. To summarize like the entire book in two sentences, you can do that. It essentially comes down to politics is about how power gets sliced up in society. So that's all part of society. It's not just parliaments. It's business. It's third sector. All these kind of things. But there's a very broad interconnected and changing landscape of power that exists. Always hasn't it just changed over time? And the reason it changes is because we're a democracy and we kind of indirectly choose how we want our country to be run. We kind of go, yeah, more power for bankers or less power for bankers over a long period of time. Just as a brief introduction to this, so an example would be a good way to illustrate this is with a couple of MPs and sort of show how they dot about, jump between different areas. So this is Nicholas Soames, who has a not particularly flattering Wikipedia page, which he described as the most sexist and fattest man in Parliament. So he started out working for Prince Charles years ago, and then went to Lloyds, I think, in the city, and then was in Parliament, and then was kind of nearly in the cabinet. As a defence minister, then went to work for the defence industry and another bank. Tony Blair started out as a lawyer, obviously. Went to Parliament, became a peace envoy, became an academic, working at Yale, and is on the board of a couple of banks, which ones they are now. Yeah.
He was Prime Minister as well at one point.
Yeah, I missed out that slide. How did we forget? Trying to blank it out. And kind of as a result, kind of ended up in the rich category. That's just an example of the way it is. So we got talking and thinking about if there is this kind of broad landscape of power and it's how our countries run. What monitors have we got in place for dealing with this? And specifically, because we're techies, what kind of technological tools are there out there for monitoring these things? And if you look at the ones we've got, they're really quite heavily based around Parliament and the Prime Minister. Journalists need to top the tank. Is a site about the media. And what do they know about problems? Lots of stuff for Whitehall, but it's really very much parliamentary based. So we're ignoring kind of huge swathes of the power base in this country. So we started thinking, really, what can we make? What data's out there? What can we come up with? How do we link all this stuff up? Is it even worth it? We basically stuck a load of post-it notes on. If we find it. Stuck loads of post-it notes on the diagram and started trying to think of some things. So the purpose of this talk is really ideas that we've come up with, things that we've been involved with, things we think people should make, random data sets, and we're just going to kind of work our way around that diagram and do bits and pieces. So, first thing we're talking about is political parties. So, even though all the focus has been on MPs recently, parties hold a lot of power, the whip famously, but lots of other bits and pieces as well. So, and other people exert influence on those parties. So this, so GroPlan, which is the party funding database, so you can see who's giving what particular parties. Which one? That's Conservative one. So I'll just say
that this is a data set that's on the Electoral Commission website, and there's all sorts of registers there that we haven't scraped, and I can't believe we haven't scraped them, particularly because when a company donates, they include the company registration number, which we'll talk a little bit more about later, but it's the first government data set I've seen with actually used the company registration number.
I mean, you can get some interesting stuff out of that. So European elections a couple of weeks ago, this was a pretty much a new party, Libertas.eu, and they're a cross-Europe party. And if you look at where they came from, they're basically financed by the guy who financed the Irish No campaign against the, I can't remember his name, it's in my notes somewhere, I take a word for it. Sorry? Yeah, but I can't remember the guy's name. Who is it? Sorry?
McGanley.
Yes, I think so. Declan?
Declan Ganley.
Yeah. So he has actually financed this entirely new party. And if you look at what his background is, all his money comes from dealings with American arms companies. So it's potentially, he provides telecom solutions to the military. So there's potentially a suggestion that maybe, like, why is he anti-European? Is it because his money comes from interests which would be happy to see a weakened EU? Another kind of area of political parties that goes, it's kind of hidden away, but is usually important when it comes to election times. Election leaflets. This website, strikechoice.org, was a website that I set up with Julian Todd, who runs Public Whip, about a month ago for the European elections. And it's a crowdsourced application, basically encouraging people to take photos of election leaflets as they come to their door, fill in a bit of details, who it's attacking, which party it's from, postcode so we can map them, and try and examine what parties are saying and hold them to it. So there's a by-election in about 3 weeks' time in Norwich, where I'm going tomorrow to hand out leaflets to promote Straight Choice, rock and roll. These are the leaflets that have been coming through so far, and they're making kind of fairly vague promises, but there's some promises they're making in there. So I can't read them here, but essentially what it comes down to is parties are making promises to the local electorate. And in the past, these things have just disappeared. People forget about them once those promises have been made. So we can start using technology to monitor what they're saying. One example from the Lib Dems here. Well, this is something we noticed during the European elections with this information, that Liberal Democrats are quite bad at using graphs, I'm afraid. They tend to use different graphs in different areas. So Lib Dems are famously in favour of PR, proportional representation, but they don't use the PR data if it doesn't suit them in a particular area. So we'll use PR, or we'll use the wider European sector, like the southeast of England, or we'll use a ward or a constituency. Whatever makes the graph look good. So you always see these words, like so-and-so can't win here, you don't have luxury to vote green. The idea with the Straight Choice is to try and start documenting some of these promises so we can hold politicians to account later. Next kind of area is media stuff. So this kind of fits in what Ben Goldacre was saying downstairs. This was a vague idea I had for a way to start monitoring what the media is saying and trying to associate some value of truthfulness to an article. So if you imagine a really basic mock-up where you just give somebody a random newspaper article and you ask them a simple question, can you find any sources to support this point of view? And you just get people to add it, and then you can start to give scores to newspapers to particular articles and say how truthful or untruthful, well, in theory. Just a random idea. Did you want to speak about this one?
Right. So this is an example from New Zealand, largely, which is, I'm originally from New Zealand, so I'm quite familiar with some of the activity there. So what we've noticed is that if you look at certain newspaper articles that appear to be a journalist writing a sort of a piece about some area or issue, the provenance of that material can often be actually from a press release, which is produced by a public relations agency on behalf of a corporation. So this website, which has largely New Zealand material on it, called Scoop, just publishes the press releases. Forget the intermediary bit where the journalist sort of makes it look like it's actually something that's been considered and well thought through. And Where Scoop works really well, this is scoop.co.nz, is it collects press releases about a particular issue and puts them together in one place. So then you can view many sides of an issue and an argument. And then Scoop calls this a news website because essentially it's providing a news-like service, but maybe with a little bit more honesty than some of the media does at the moment.
I say one more thing about the Scoop thing that's interesting is if we start getting an absolute list of all of the press releases, you can then start doing comparisons across newspaper websites. You can say which newspaper is the worst offender for just reprinting press releases and not adding any journalism to it. And again, giving paper scores, ranking them. What's it called? Yes, there you go.
Right, we've got the mic on now. So, the bankers. This is a shot from Flickr that I think it was taken after a few of them lost their jobs. So this is on a street corner in the city somewhere, and you can see this is a Lehman Brothers folder between this guy's feet. So there's various mechanisms to sort of regulate the banking industry, and in the last decade in the UK, they set up the Financial Services Agency Authority, something like that. And the interesting thing is there that the board members are actually often from the financial sector, so they're actually coming from directors of a financial firm and then to regulate the financial firm and then maybe to return to be a director of a financial firm or even stay director during that time they're regulating. So there's an issue there that if we could sort of monitor this closer, more closely, it would be interesting to follow. Also, a couple of guys who are based in the States have been very critical of the rating agencies, the credit rating agencies that gave ratings to bonds. So you've heard of a AAA bond. Well, to get your bond to be AAA, you actually go to a credit rating agency, you pay them to give you the rating. And I think there's two or three that you can go to in the States. So if you're a credit rating agency provider, one of the three, and you want to attract customers to pay you to rate their bonds, you're probably going to have a temptation to give them a better rating for their bond, so they'll come and do some more business with you. So what these guys want to do is actually open up both the data used to generate credit ratings, but also the algorithms we use to generate credit ratings. So basically, we could crowdsource credit rating and take power away from a small oligopoly of credit rating agencies. And potentially over time, we could find that actually individuals or groups in society can give better predictions of when banks are in credit trouble. So they've actually taken a few textbook examples of formulas for calculating credit risk and shown that Lehman Brothers was looking in trouble a year before the credit rating agencies actually started to lower the credit ratings. So if you were just using basic, 101 formulas, you could actually see, if you had the data to put into the formulas, that there was problems on the horizon. So their project's called Free Risk, so I think that's going to be an interesting one to watch. And once again, that's putting the power back in our hands, basically, if we can get the data. Now, the Treasury obviously control the sort of some of the shoestring budgets, the big budgets, shall I say, of the UK government. And they've just released a report called the Operational Efficiency Programme Report. And they admit that their data's not very good in government and that government actually wastes a lot of money because it doesn't have consistent comparable data. And I think that's exactly the same thing we are asking government for, is can we have consistent comparable data? And so it's interesting to see that the Treasury Department's asking itself for the same thing. And this report somehow came to a figure of £15 billion being of savings possible if they just had some sort of better internal management of the data across government. And I think largely that was around procurement. Currently, different government departments set up their own framework agreements that suppliers have to pass in order to be approved government suppliers. And so that information is in a bit of a silo at the moment. So I thought, well, hey, maybe I could help, you know, because, you know, I'm quite a sort of, you know, let's see what we can do from the outside. So I asked the main government agency for approving government suppliers in an FOI request, can I just have the company registration numbers for the approved suppliers? Because the non-unique string names that you use on your website aren't very good if I want to aggregate across government. And they told me, we actually don't collect the company registration numbers for our suppliers. This is a government department with, you know, hundreds of employees who presumably do approve suppliers. But when you ask them for the unique number, because remember, they want to give all of us a unique number to make it easier for them to track. They've already done it for companies. What was even better was they told me what I could do. They said I could go to their website, get the list of names, then go to the company's house website and do a search for each company, and hopefully I'll hit on a registration number. So I think it's these sort of problems that Treasury think if they solve them internally, maybe they'll save some money. Yes, sorry.
Register a company with the same name as one of the approved suppliers and then get some business.
Well, you can register the same name as a company that's been dissolved. So if a company that's has gone bankrupt and is dissolved, you can then register a new company with the same name. And if they haven't noticed, if it was a government supplier, yeah. I mean, that's why we don't want to use the string names of a company, because they're not unique. They're not guaranteed to be unique. Or you might leave off the bracket UK bracket limited. So I think in general, this problem could be solved if we sort of have better access to the data. So at an event earlier this year called Rewired State, five of us built a sort of a unique URL for every company via a sort of a very quick bit of code that we chucked together in a day. And that's, we just call that company's open house. And part of that was just to give you maybe a resolution service. So if you had a list of names, you could get back a list of company registration numbers. So then you could start sort of building various pieces of the puzzle that you needed. Now, USA, I think, has just sort of become, in the last few months, just racing ahead of the UK. So this site, I think, went up in the last week. It's called USA Spending. They are listing all government spending, including which supplier got the contract, and then they're aggregating it by supplier, which is exactly what I think some of us would like to do for the UK. So you can actually see in the bottom corner here, they actually list the top five contractors for this year. So Lockheed Martin got $20 billion. Boeing Company got $15 billion. Northrop Grumman Corporation got $9 billion, and the list goes on. That's all military sort of contractors. But you know, they're probably conducting vote elections in Iraq, and you know, they're probably doing all sorts of juicy contracts. But it's all there. I mean, I think internally, the Treasury would like to have this website. If you read the Operational Efficiency Program report, this is what they want. I think on the outside we want it too. So I think it's probably up to us in the audience to sort of help John Sheridan from the Office of Public Sector Information this morning gave a presentation where he was actually eliciting our help to help government. And they've got Tim Berners-Lee now sort of trying to help them open up data as well at government. So I'm hoping that we will be able to build this for the UK one day. Which leads us on to corporations, and I think Richard's going to jump in now. Yes.
Yes. Oh, yes. This is a slightly different side of corporations, what Rob was just talking about. So it's not just, we talk about not just the direct influence they have, but the kind of the power that they have amassed just by the amount of information that it's held on us. So Tesco, but just to pick a random huge supermarket, via their club card scheme, have loads and loads of information about our spending habits, what we're buying, when we're buying it, and started thinking, what if we had control of that information rather than them having control of that information? So there's some really obvious things you can do, just like group together and then sell that. Because obviously Tesco sells that information on for loads of money. So we could do that ourselves just by pooling our information and selling it on. But you could also start doing things like listing the companies that you have most interaction with. So say you get your shopping bill for the entire year and you took the top 10 companies that you're buying things off of. You could start then getting automatic email alerts saying, you're buying loads of stuff from Nestle, here are their company reports. Getting hooks into companies that way by controlling your own information. There's something somebody said, but I can't actually verify, I can't find it on the internet anyway, so it might not be true. But somebody, apparently from Tesco, quoted that they can tell if someone's going to become diabetic just by looking at their club card data. It's that kind of fine out. You see the number of sugary foods that someone's buying goes up. So this is just an idea. What if we had that information, what could we do? And it kind of fits in with a project I was involved with a couple of weeks ago for an organization called Consumer Focus. And it was a product recalls database. It just basically scrapes the European Union's recall data. There is no UK one. Don't know where it comes from. If you phone up Burr, or whatever they're called these days,
Biz.
If you phone them up, they go, no, sorry, we haven't got it, and it's probably copyrighted. even though somewhere in a bit of law they're required to collect it, and they're obviously giving it to the EU, but they don't know how they're doing it. That was a bit of a... So we built this website, which is just a list of product recalls. But imagine if you link that up with your buying habits from Tesco, then you can actually start getting emails saying that tin of baby food you bought, that was actually dangerous, take it back to the shop. So one thing I meant to say on the previous slide is actually we potentially have access to this information via the Data Protection Act. Some Guardian journalists requested their profiles, but they didn't actually request the raw data. So something I'm kind of working on at the moment is trying to work out what the process is for getting this raw data, what format it comes back in, and whether we could maybe build a website where people can automatically request their information from Tesco, get it cleaned up, and then get it presented back to them in the similar kind of format to that USA spending website, where it shows you what you're buying, what companies you have interactions with, links out to what their environmental impact is, absolutely everything. I think that's on that one. Lobbyists.
Okay. You see, there's a revolving door with the mic here. We can't remember the next slide, so we're having to... Oh, yes. So... The Parliament had a committee that did an inquiry into lobbying over the last year, and the report came out of that Parliament committee in January, and it recommended that there actually be more of a statutory requirement to record lobbyist activity in the UK, and it analysed sort of the way this was being done in other countries like the United States. Which have a much greater requirement for information to be sort of collected. So once again, I thought, well, how far could we get in the UK right now if we just sort of screen scraped and what was currently publicly available? And I did put up a splash page called Who's Lobbying, and there's actually nothing there yet. But the sort of information I found that we do have is there are some firms that are... They call themselves political consultants, but I think we'd call them lobbyist firms. And they basically, you as a corporation will hire them to represent your side of an issue to Parliament or to the government. There were some scandals in the 90s where I think some members of Parliament were being paid and then making certain amendments, putting certain amendments into bills. And under the threat of regulation, industry said, oh, we'll self-regulate. Don't worry, we'll do the self-regulation route. And so there is a register now where some of the lobbyist firms say who their clients are and which staff they hire. But you still don't know who they're lobbying or what issues they're lobbying on. But we could aggregate by company which lobbyist firms they've hired. And the other information that was sort of caught my eye was the government has an advisory committee on business appointments, and each minister, when they leave and go back to the private sector, if they do, they have to get approval for their private sector activity. And it's quite small print here, but we have Tony Blair, who was a former prime minister, and he sought to take some engagements, including being a senior advisor at JP Morgan. And we see that the advisory committee approved that and said he couldn't For 12 months after leaving office, he should not be personally involved in lobbying UK government ministers. But after that 12-month period, it's all okay again. And a newspaper article in the Times, I think, suggested that he's received about $2.5 million in fees through the JP Morgan job, and another $2 million in fees with being an advisor with Zurich Financial Services. And recently, they seem to keep this register up to date, because in February 2009, there's a new entry there saying it's actually Tony Blair set up his own consulting company now, so it's Tony Blair's Associates. So if you have got an amendment or some issue you'd like someone in government to address, you can now hire Tony Blair to go talk to people in government, and we obviously don't know what the fees are there. There's a question.
Some tame lobbyists.
Yeah. Well, I know we don't know exactly what impact this has. I mean, this might be fine. I don't think either Richard or I are saying that what this is bad, or but it's just interesting. We don't know what, you know, we only know pieces of the puzzle, and it would just be interesting to know more, I think. So yeah, sure, if you've got money, this is probably one way you can get your issues presented to government. But all this information is hidden in PDFs, and it is fairly obscure. So once again, it could all be aggregated together. But you see, we don't have the company registration numbers there. So which JP Morgan Chase was that? If you go to Companies House, it's about 20, 30 companies with that. So I think that was a sort of a broad, very quick walk around that graph that we saw at the beginning. So I think from here, we were going to maybe open it up. Actually, yeah. There's one more slide I know. So we sort of filled out that diagram with a few projects that we've seen, sort of nascent projects that are emerging here in the UK. So we can see that, including the ones we covered before, we've added this Straight Choice there, which is the election leaflet site. Open Knowledge Foundation are looking at doing more analysis of the budget information in an open manner, and including sort of visualizing the budget information. We've got the couple of things that sort of got started that may or may not go anywhere, the Who's Lobbying an Open Companies House. Some of the investigative journalists have started a project called Help Me Investigate, and I know Heather Brooke, who's here in the audience, is involved with that, so she might want to make a point during question time. Spinwatch is an organisation that's been monitoring the public relations industry and sort of keeping an eye on what they're up to. So we can see that slowly we're actually filling up the parts of this puzzle.
Yeah, I would say also it's not just filling this out, but it's beginning to work out how all these different bits link together. So you know, there were quite a few trends through most of those examples, quick as they were. So if you knew, if you had a decent list of companies with company numbers, if you had that information, political party information index with those same numbers, if we could link all this stuff up, essentially, we could do a lot more.
Thanks very much. So the title of the session was What's Next After Politicians? And the answer seems to be everyone. So there's plenty to discuss. Richard was looking at me when he talked about the election leaflet site, which is the most dangerous part of all of this, and I know there's at least one other politician in the audience here who was looking very nervous at that moment, and that's because I used to be a Lib Dem politician, and the inside track is we used to spend hours fighting over the graphs that I actually wanted it to be accurate, and I would ask for it to be shorter, and then the campaigns were saying you've got to kind of use these distorted graphs. I finally won the argument in my constituency when the school children in the local primary school sent me the homework exercise they'd done where they'd all measured the bar chart and were able to prove how inaccurate it was. And they were 11. So at that point I said it wasn't doing us any good.
But was it the white election?
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, question at the back.
Just on that last point, the last point that
Bob Richard.
These together. I mean, you were talking about the Whitehall not having a government, not
essentially you have to do a match with a string identifier and do a screen scrape of it to get the full data. So it's actually one thing I'm interested in, trying to see if we can develop ways of sharing information in an easy, scalable way.
Yeah, well, I think parts of this puzzle could be an API as well as a website. So I think...
Same thing!
Okay, someone said that's the same thing. But we know that if you only have an API, people who can't program have nothing to see. So you do have a slight difference. But so I think the company information is quite a critical linchpin for a lot of other information. So I think if we do work on that and maybe have an API, both to sort of resolve a company name to a real sort of hard identifier, which is hopefully a URL. And now that Tim Berners-Lee is there helping government understand persistent URLs, I think we might get some agreement on that part. But then you can start using that unique identifier for a company to attach or as a hook to hang all the other information you find as you sort of crawl across what's currently publicly available. And then eventually I think we'll get a better picture of government that even government itself wants here in the UK. Like, I don't think what we're doing here is necessarily something that people really want to resist at any level, whether from the outside of government or from inside. Whether it suits the rich, which we really haven't talked about, but unfortunately, to get the director's information from Companies House, you have to pay a pound per company because Companies House is operated as a trading fund. So, yeah.
Just to reiterate again, the purpose of doing this is not to bash any particular area of society. I think people want to know what's going on, and the more eyes on this, hopefully, the better society can create as a result. It's worth going at the. Where is this? Yeah, that slide there was supposed to kind of represent what we're talking about with APIs. This keeps coming out.
Yeah.
Is that working?
No.
So, yay, that works. There is a bit of work of, sort of scaffolding to be done before we can do a lot of this stuff. So companies is part of it. Products, if you want to do some of the Tesco stuff I was talking about, we need a list of products, maybe indexed by barcodes, which companies are owned by. Unique identifiers for councils, for other government organisations. We need to build some of that stuff first, yes. But I don't think we should spend a long time discussing exactly how we do it. It's just first person to build a decent company's website, that's it. First person to build a decent list of local authorities that doesn't change, that's it. And then we start linking them together.
Have you looked at this sort of stuff much on an international level? I know I'd be quite interested to see what's going on in terms of lobbying in run up to the Copenhagen Climate Conference in December.
No. Julian Todd did a project on the UN called undemocracy.org.com that tries to match countries' voting habits. That's probably the main international thing I know about that, and farmsubsidy.org that matches where farm CAP payments go to. But there's a lot to be done nationally before we can do anything wider, I think.
Yeah, let's take John Sheridan's response to that.
Thank you.
operation in, you know, Northamptonshire or something. Well, perhaps we should be doing something to make sure that you do your job right. As a third party, kind of, you know, keep it honest kind of thing.
Sure. I mean, John would like, just for those who went to the session earlier, John is your friend. just in response to the question about lobbying, I mean, the fact is that there is a group of people inside government who are completely signed up for this. So it isn't all us against them, it's us against some of them and with some of the others of them. John is one. Tom Watson at the back there, who should wave, is a member of parliament who is was working on this agenda as a minister and now will continue to work on this agenda as a backbench MP. We're not allowed to. Richard Stirling, who was here this morning for the cabinet, there's a whole bunch of people, and one of the things we can do in these kind of environments is make sure that those people who've got great ideas and skills and expertise link up with people like John and Tom and others. And we can move things a bit faster that way as well. Question.
Yeah. So, just thinking about procurement and not having the registration numbers with companies that actually basically getting these contracts, is that not a simple case to fix the procurement form so
you
actually have...
I'm not sure exactly. I know that the suppliers would have to provide their company registration number to become a supplier. I think that answer really meant the database we use to generate this list doesn't have that in it, and hence we're not going to do the extra work to figure out how to do that. So I'm sure they've got that number. They must have it. Yeah. I'll just skip. So we've got, okay, attributions for the photos. But we just wanted to alert everyone that there's another event coming up on the 26th of July, which is a bar camp around transparency. And that's going to be in Oxford. So I know I'm going to be trying to attend that. And if you're interested in this area, I'm sure it's going to be a really interesting sort of bar camp to go to. So that's in Oxford. Okay.
We can stop seeing some of these things appearing, basically.
Right. But this is a question directed partly to the public and partly to various members of government around. And that is that we have lobbyists who circle around trying to influence the state in various ways. Does the state actually to make any effort to track what they're doing for its own use?
To track what the lobbyists are doing?
Exactly, yes, because it strikes me that there's obviously a case to replicate the MPs' expenses model and just throw a bucket of Freedom of Information Act requests to all the MPs and all the permanent secretaries for all their meetings and then slurp that into some vaguely usable form after many hours of screen scraping and retyping. But wouldn't it be effective? The better struggle is that given that these people are trying to alter the government's, trying to influence the government's interests, doesn't the government take any interest in monitoring them itself?
Tom, I think you have a passing acquaintance with this subject.
Yeah,
do you want?
There's not a simple answer to that because there's not a wave of one solution. But the answer is yes, there are many. As a result of the public administration select mechanism report, which was published about 6-7 months ago, there's been a series of things that have gone on. Not least last week, we criminalised paid advocacy. Essentially means having guys that don't want them in the 90s before, and they don't go to jail rather than just be humiliated in the
got no choice.
No, exactly. But I think, you know, there's an argument I brought at the Guardian thing this week. You know, for us to advance this, all this agenda quicker, we have to have a separate view in government of political parties, of civil service, the internet, as a force of good. And everyone says it is, but everyone thinks it's a force of good in someone else's field of work, not their own. And so it requires strong leadership at the heart of government, which I think is beginning to come now. I mean, to be fair to both party leaders, who come at this from different angles, all three party leaders, beginning to understand what this is. Where I think there is a gap, and what I thought was interesting in the presentation, is actually the British media. My observation from the States is it's much more of a sort of declaratory sort of culture amongst journalists about their interests and about their, you know, they quite often put disclaimers in their articles. That just doesn't really happen in the UK. And so those two initiatives, I would say, would actually help bring transparency to how stories are reported, and that's, you know, that's obviously a big factor in the harm of women as well.
So we've got about 3 minutes left, obviously. A couple of hands up, take these last questions on there.
Back on the thing about lobbyists, it is worth noting, of course, that there isn't a clear definition of, you know, this person is a lobbyist. If I go and see my MP about something I care about, is that lobbying? If I represent my old street, will I do so? Is that lobbying? If we formed a small company to do social housing in our area and I go and see them about that, is that lobbying? You know, if actually we're a profit making business, does it become lobbying? You know, you say all the lobbyists as if they're these nefarious people who try to influence government for the bad, but everyone goes to see your MP about things that you care about, and that could be things to do with your business.
I think there's a definition they use in the United States, which is paid people who are paid who conduct a certain percentage of their working day lobbying Congress. So it's they use whether you're being paid to do that activity or not. So yeah, you're right. I mean, there's a lot of NGOs and charities and community interest groups that lobby as well. So yeah, it's not just corporations lobbying.
It's also a lot of MPs complain that they don't get. People don't see the good work they do. We don't have any measures for when they're talking to their constituents, when they're spending time in surgeries and stuff like that. And this is the kind of the positive side of some of this stuff, that it's not about bashing everybody left, right and centre. It's about also revealing where there's good practice, where, say, you've got one MP who is spending 70% of their time with lobbyists, someone who's spending like 5%. You know, it might reveal other kinds of patterns. It's not necessarily negatives coming out of this, I don't think.
I think we're supposed to wrap up. The man with the security T-shirt is looking at me. Am I allowed one more question? Well, there are two hands out quickly. Do you want to double that? Who were the two I saw a minute ago? You two. Yeah, do you want to ask your question quickly together? And then
I'll make a very general point. It doesn't necessarily mean that for all of us here, not to forget about how to talk, in addition to the comments. So the last bit of money being taken
from
management,
what's in
the
floor of
that
church?
Yeah.
The cabinet's mostly Lord Day,
isn't
it?
And I was just going to mention that one way of addressing, you know, how do we classify a lobbyist, or, you know, who might be interested in, is kind of graph theoretic network analysis. And I'd like to see kind of more of that in conjunction with things like speed scoring.
Can we repeat that again for those who catch it?
So using kind of graph theoretic network analysis on kind of
Yeah, the problem is company directors is probably part of that graph you want to visualise, and that you have to pay for that data right now. So
we need John Sheridan to free companies' house data.
Yes, and make that trading funds assessment report public, because it's secret. They did a report into the trading funds, including companies' house, and it's secret. We haven't seen it. We should FI it, Heather. Yeah, it's there you go. Action point for today.
Thank you very much. Can we thank our speakers again, and thank you for the discussion.
Thank you.
Okay.